Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. This hour, we're going to be joined by Lara Trump, who's standing by, Lexi Rigdon, to go inside the Trump trials, as well as what's happened with the documents case. We'll keep you up to date on that. And Frank Siller, Tons of Towers founder and CEO. It's always great to have him on, and it's always great to support him, especially Memorial Day is upon us. Don't forget, you could always get the show on podcast, BrianKilmeadeShow.com, if you ever leave your local affiliate, but we hope you don't. So, but you might be traveling today. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The Jordanians told the MP officers that they were working for this Amazon subcontractor. But after an exhaustive search in their internal records, Amazon told us on background yesterday that all of their deliveries to that area that day were done, and they have no records or indication that these two individuals were doing any kind of work.
Do you believe this? So the people that tried to breach Fort Detrick, they said they were Jordanian Amazon delivery people. Amazon says they don't work for us. There was a breach of our base, and it took us 2 weeks to find out that took place. Unacceptable. Why don't you fix it? That's the message from the White House when asked about the southern border in invasion. While home security continues to evade, Homeland Security continues to evade when it comes to details on the military breach by illegal aliens, one of which came from the San Diego sector.
Number two.
Is that why you used your Gmail instead of your official mail for communication with Peter?
Using my Gmail was for a different purpose. That was for avoiding more embarrassment and danger to him.
And specifically, as your emails say, avoiding FOIA.
No. Well, yeah, I guess you could say that.
Liar, deceiver. Fauci and friends caught hiding the facts, figures, and emails during COVID. We have the gory details and why an apology just won't do.
Number one.
I'm confident that the people of the Bronx are not going to buy the snake oil he's selling. I mean, his presidency was a catastrophe for the Bronx. His mismanagement of COVID left a death toll of more than 7,000 in the Bronx.
More people died after getting the vaccine with President Biden than died with President Trump. We didn't know what the hell China was giving us. Trump takes on the Bronx, as promised. He continues to try and shine in Biden country as Joe fires back with a rare press conference of his own with Kenya. Expect another gaffe-tastic performance, although a new Q poll gives him hope. Let's bring in Lara Trump, Republican National Committee co-chair. Congratulations, Lara. Number one, for the first time that I know of, you guys, the Republicans, have outraised the Democrats last month.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, it's something we're very proud of. And I think, Brian, if you look at the fact that our average donation is $29, it shows you that the people of this country, even right now, whenever Joe Biden has given us one of the worst economic situations in decades, people are still donating their money to the Trump campaign and to the RNC because I think people truly feel what is at stake right now. So you're right. Last month, $76 million for Donald Trump, Joe Biden, $51 million. We are outraising them and we are outpolling them every possible place. And as I just heard you talk about, Donald Trump will be in the Bronx today. We all remember the last time a Republican candidate for president went there. It was Ronald Reagan in 1980. And I remember what the map was like after he did that.
Listen, I love it. And I also think people like Joe Biden should go to Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, Oklahoma City, and try to convince people that you're right for the country. And don't just stay in the places that are going to vote for you and max out that area. I would love to see more of this. And that's why I hope it goes smooth today. And on some level, I think Democrats should hope it goes smooth today. You need to create a dialogue with people that just shut you out or say that you ignore them. How many times have you heard Republicans say, look at these cities, run Democratic run, all going to hell, but they don't show up and campaign for the seat or campaign for the vote? Am I right, Lara?
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, we have a huge opportunity right now with Donald Trump and really with where we are in this country, Brian, to bring people into this party. I mean, never have you seen polling like we have right now, whether you're talking about the Hispanic communities across this country, where Donald Trump right now in a head-to-head matchup with Joe Biden wins with Hispanic voters. Where you look at black voters right now, Donald Trump won 9% of the black vote in 2020. He's polling at 23%. And the truth is, it doesn't matter where you live. It doesn't matter who you are or what happens in your life day to day. Everything is harder for you because of Joe Biden and the Democrats and their poor policies. Everything they've done has turned our life in America in the wrong direction. And it's right. a really easy contrast right now because we don't have to wonder, well, how would Donald Trump be as president? We had him for 4 years. People remember how their life was. And so whether you're talking about going to the South Bronx, whether you're talking about going to Oklahoma, we have to get out there. We have to engage with people. And I think we can bring people into this party right now who are not just going to be here for the votes in 2024. In future elections, and believe me, the Democrats are terrified of that exact thing.
So the president, the former president of the United States, who was his last remaining rival in the primaries, Nikki Haley, and the former governor of South Carolina has been pretty quiet since, and it got pretty brutal when they were going head-to-head. It got very personal, and Governor Nikki Haley was at the Hudson Institute yesterday and put a lot of questions to rest. Cut one.
As a voter, I put my priorities on a president who's going to have the backs of our allies and hold our enemies to account, who would secure the border, no more excuses, a president who would support capitalism and freedom, a president who understands we need less debt, not more debt. Trump has not been perfect on these policies. I've made that clear many, many times. But Biden has been a catastrophe. So I will be voting for Trump. Having said that, I stand by what I said in my suspension speech. Trump would be smart to reach out to the millions of people who voted for me and continue to support me and not assume that they're just going to be with him. And I genuinely hope he does that.
Your thoughts about that and the advice?
Yeah, well, listen, this is a party that's unifying right now. And I think you're seeing that across the board. Look at all of the obviously the former folks who had decided to run for president against my father-in-law and did not make it through the primaries. They've all now come over and says they are supporting him, including Nikki Haley. And I think that's a great thing for the party and for the country, because I think unification only means that we are going to be successful in the months ahead and come November 5th. And I think she's right. I think we need to bring everybody in. This is a time where everyone can really feel what is at stake right now, because whether it is the fact that people can't afford their lives right now, whether it's the fact that you have literally a party utilizing communist tactics against their number one political opponent in the way we've seen lawfare waged at Donald Trump. If we are not successful as a party come November 5th, if Donald Trump is not reelected as president, if we don't take back the Senate and expand our lead in the House, then we are in for a world of hurt. We are not going to have the same country left on the other side. We are reaching out to all voters across America. We are partnering with our grassroots partners across the country. We are doing things much differently right now than I think you've ever seen done, at least from the RNC perspective. And we intend to reach out to every voter, including people who voted for Nikki Haley in those primaries, and say, now is the time to come together. Now is the time we have to go forward and save this country.
How would you describe?
We welcome her support.
Larry Trump, how would you describe a Nikki Haley supporter, and how do you target them?
Well, I think these are people who probably have unfortunately bought into a little bit of what the mainstream media has broadcast of Donald Trump. They've tried to make it a little bit more about personality than policies. And I think we just, again, to go back to, you know, the contrast between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, we have to remind people about what life was like with Donald Trump, remind them all of the great things that he actually did for this country, whether it was having the most secure border in decades, whether it's trade agreements with China, Mexico, and Canada, whether talks with Kim Jong-un and actual peace agreements in the Middle East instead of a war breaking out in the Middle East. These are things we need to go back and we need to reach out to people who might have bought into you should vote for someone based on their personality versus their policies, and re-engage with them and say, take a look at it. There's no way any of these people can actually vote for a guy like Joe Biden, because every policy he has had has led this country in the wrong direction. So we're going to be spread out across the country, and we're going to be talking to everyone.
Do you think that the Haley camp, or are you going to reach out to the Haley camp, or is that something that comes from the Trump team or doesn't come from the Trump team?
Well, I think this is a nice olive branch that she extended, and we're happy to have that support. And again, the cohesion and the unity in this party right now. And so, you know, we'll kind of take a step back. We'll see what happens. But certainly we are open to working alongside anyone who has the same goals of saving this country. And she is no exception, and her team is no exception.
All right. I want you to hear one congressman is not looking forward to your event, or President Trump's event today at in the Bronx, where they expect at least 3,500 people in the park at 6 p.m. And it's Congressman Richie Torres of New York. Cut 9.
I'm confident that the people of the Bronx are not going to buy the snake oil he's selling. I mean, his presidency was a catastrophe for the Bronx. His mismanagement of COVID left a death toll of more than 7,000 in the Bronx, which is greater than the combined death count of Pearl Harbor and 9/11. So instead of holding a rally in Crotona Park, he should be apologizing to the people of the Bronx for the damage he's done.
Your reaction.
It's amazing. A catastrophe, really, whenever people had more money in their pockets when you got the largest tax cut in American history, whenever you actually had peace breaking out in the world instead of wars, when you had a president who on the world stage was respected by both our allies and our adversaries. I mean, it's laughable to hear these things. And I would love to know what kind of snake oil they think that Trump is bringing. You know, he is reaching people. He's saying, I'm here. I want to hear from you. I want to engage with you. Where's Joe Biden? Why isn't Joe Biden in the Bronx today? It's because he cannot actually go look in the face of people across this country and say, I tried to do the best thing for your life. Because his first order of business, Brian, shutting down the Keystone XL pipeline, escalated inflation. It caused the wars that we've seen break out around the world. It's put us in a very weakened state as a country. And everything he has done from that moment all the way to this day, right now, here in 2024, has been bad for America. People are open right now to hearing a different viewpoint. They're open right now to somebody who will actually show up and engage with them, and that will be Donald Trump tonight at 6 p.m.
And Laura, the other thing, let's just, if you want to go back to COVID, Richie Torres, go back. Let's go back. Your governor had no problem with this. Your mayor told everyone to continue partying in Little Italy. Remember, it was the getting the all the ventilators, which ended up killing people, was something President Trump did because Governor Cuomo needed it. Remember, we got that Red Cross ship, I forgot the name of it, immediately over to New York Harbor. There was so much that was done for New York. It was the first one hit, but it was the governor and mayor that was responsible. It's a mayor that a local congressman should feel more responsible than a sitting president. So it's unbelievable where they're going to blame COVID and the president's response on that. It's nuts.
Yeah, when everybody knows that. I mean, look, Donald Trump was not the person forcing medical procedures for people. I'll remind everyone, that was Joe Biden when he became president, right? This is a very different animal. This was a novel virus. This is something we'd never dealt with before. And you have to give Donald Trump a lot of credit for mobilizing the federal government, as you just pointed out, Brian, in the way he did. It was incredible to see. But yeah, they use the identity politics to say, don't be afraid. Go party in Chinatown. Go party in Little Italy, because we don't want to offend somebody by saying that anything. It was crazy, of course. And now here they are. And that's literally the only way they think they can convince people, because people are smart enough to know that while you hear a lot of talking points from the Democrats and they say, oh, you shouldn't vote for Donald Trump because he's not a great guy, they remember what their life was like. And they're like, I don't know. I feel like my life was a lot better with Donald Trump in office. I think I might vote for him. They're terrified of that on the Democrat side. And they should be, because every poll that we've seen out there indicates things are going in the right way for Donald Trump and in the wrong way for Joe Biden.
Well, no one could doubt that how hard you're working and the results you're bringing in. Lara Trump's got her hands full, because I tell you, the Democrats do have a money making machine. I just give the president so much credit for going into the Bronx when no one else would. I don't see Biden going there and having a open air rally and just saying, let's see who the chips fall. They may. The last Siena poll has the president, the former president, within 9 points of Joe Biden. And there's a New York, a Republican has not won New York since Ronald Reagan in 1980. Thanks so much, Laura. Best of luck.
You got it. Thank you, Brian.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. I left some time at the, did much better than usual. I left some time in the second half of this before the bottom of the hour. Then we'll talk a little about the Trump cases with Lexi Rigdon. And then we know what's coming up. Memorial Day weekend. No one has to remind Frank Siller of that. Tunnel to Towers Foundation is out there helping those whose families are left behind after their loved one dies in battle, or first responders lose their lives helping us out, keeping our streets safe. He's going to be joining us with his message for Memorial Day. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform. And watch directly on Outkick.com/watch.
out of the gates and ready to go.
Hey, it's Hutton Withrow. Hot Mike is here on the Outkick Network. We've got your afternoon covered with the latest sports discussion, and it's available wherever you find your audio.
Daily analysis and news. He is hot. I am Mike. Actually, my name is Chad. His name is Jonathan, but you get the picture. We're going to bring it every single day. Whatever you want to call us, we'll respond to. We just want you to respond to what we're dishing out every day.
And while you're here, we hope you subscribe to the podcast, like, subscribe, and share.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Look, obviously, we have to be careful not to treat the Latino community as a monolith, right? There are elements of the Latino community that are open to voting for Republicans. George W. Bush won 40% of the vote in 2020. Having said all that, I'm confident that the Bronx is going to overwhelmingly reject Donald Trump. Based on the polling data that I've seen among likely voters in the Bronx, Donald Trump is so unpopular as to be radioactive. You know, he's even less popular than arsenic in the Bronx. So I'm confident that the Bronx is going to overwhelmingly support Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, that's Richie Torres, who's come out for, and I was encouraged that he was somewhat balanced in his view. He's come out for Israel and all this controversy and against a lot of the campus unrest. But we've been trying to book him for a while, but he is vehemently, this is his district where Donald Trump's going to be. He is vehemently anti-Trump. He believes everyone in the Bronx is. Now, the one thing I say, the Rachel Campos Duffy came in today, and she spent yesterday in the South Bronx. She's from Arizona, lived in Wisconsin, and has never been to the Bronx before or a Yankee game. She had no idea what to expect. And she said, Brian, it was unbelievable how many people were positive for Donald Trump in the Bronx. Here's Alex in Brooklyn. Hey, Alex.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah, I'm going to be by that rally this evening, and I'm really looking forward to it. I know there are going to be some protests, but it's interesting that the Democrats have to set up an official protest to counter the Trump rally. And with Joe Biden, he could do an event with a few hundred people and have a few people stand up without a setup beforehand that there's going to be a protest. You have a few people standing up and protesting against Joe Biden because they genuinely don't like the guy and they think his policies were disastrous for the country. But with Trump, you have thousands of people together at a rally. Nobody protests unless the Democrats, you know, you had it in New Jersey, and now they have to set it up so it should look bad for Trump. But really, nobody's interested in protesting against Trump because the guy's just fantastic.
See, let him go out there. He's barely going to use the prompter. He's going to keep it crisp and try to find out what resonates, but he doesn't have to. He grew up right there. So, and you know, if you look at where he grew up, he didn't grow up in a palace. You know, he grew up in a nice area of Queens. No doubt about it. His dad was really successful. His dad also worked 20 hours a day. So, I mean, he knows nothing but hard work, and he always related to blue-collar people. That's why when people say go to the Bronx, it might seem foreign to people in D.C., but for people in New York, we're used to seeing Donald Trump. I love that he's doing it, Alex. I mean, I just hope he's able to get his lines out. There'll be people that try to disrupt it. I get it. But for the most part, let's hear what he has to say. I mean, I would love people of the Bronx to show up. I just don't want to see all Staten Island, which loves Trump, and Long Island, for the most part, who loves Trump. I want to see people in the Bronx go. And I want to hear what they, and know what they know after. I'm not going to be on location, but Lawrence Jones will be there, and he's going to have the camera and microphone and see if the president can convince people. How about this, Alex? It's respect. It's made to people of the Bronx. You're getting respect from the Republican Party. I mean, what's bad about that? What is bad about it? Thanks so much for the call. There's nothing. What are you angry at? Nothing. Say, hey, I'd love your vote. You don't usually give me your vote. You haven't given Republicans vote in 30 years. I just want you to know, you matter, and I hope to win you over. What is wrong? And what if you don't agree with his policies, well, go back to where you were. You're not voting for him. It's okay. Nothing.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
President Biden and District Attorney Bragg have taken the unthinkable and turned it into the tolerable, and I fear that it will eventually become the normal. And the attitude of many people will be, two wrongs don't make it right, but they do make it even. And that is dangerous for America's political system and our criminal justice system. President Biden, I was hoping he would govern with knowledge and wisdom. He has governed with appetite and ambition. His term has just been one long prayer. The only way we're going to find justice in America is in a voting booth.
And that is Senator Kennedy putting it all together from what he's seen in this trial. But where are we at with this trial? Well, we're going to find out. Judge Mushan hopes to provide final jury instruction to the attorneys by the end of today, Thursday. It is unclear if the instructions will be made publicly yet. I hope so. The judge expects closing arguments the entire day on Tuesday. We do not know how much time each will need. The judge also asked the jury if they'll stay later on Tuesday, too, in case closing goes past 6:30. I think in many ways it's to their advantage to do that. Let's bring in a legal expert, Lexi Rigdon, attorney and legal analyst. Lexi, your thoughts about what we should be looking forward to since Trump does not have to be in the court today. But this is a big day, isn't it?
It's a huge day. The charge conference where, I mean, they already started the charge conference, but where the judge and the attorneys argue about what's actually going to be read to the jury and instructed to them in coming to their verdict, that's enormously consequential. And they were arguing, yes, on the 21st about a variety of things, intent, causation. The prosecution wanted certain things in. The defense wanted certain things in. There was kind of laughter about some very complicated word that I had never actually heard of. I can't even remember it off the top of my head. It's like esenomary or something like that, that the judge said that he said it 100 times and he can't figure it out. He can't figure out how to pronounce it correctly. So they took it out of the potential jury charge. So that's probably not the word. You might have somebody listening that knows exactly what I'm talking about. But it was there was a lot of back and forth, and it is hugely consequential what the jury is presented with in that context.
So one thing that they wanted the jury to be told again that Donald Trump is not being charged for election interference. Michael Cohen was convicted of that, but doesn't mean Donald Trump was involved in that. They didn't get that. They said, you said that enough. But what else do you, if you're doing the defense, what would you like the jury to be instructed to know, reinforced or told?
Well, one of the things that the defense had wanted was the judge to let the jury know that NDAs are not illegal. And that was another thing that I believe the judge said, that you guys have said that enough. We know that. I mean, in the judge's defense, I certainly don't agree with everything he's done in this case. And I think that would be a throwaway line that he could easily put in there. But then I guess the argument becomes every high point that the prosecution and the defense want to make can't possibly make it into the jury instructions, because of course they're going to be giving closings to the jury also. And so that the jury charge isn't 5 hours long, I guess they're trying to streamline it. I mean, depending on who you support in this case, you could kind of look at it either way. But one of the things that the defense wanted was an instruction that the intent to commit, the intent to commit the crime and the intent to defraud, they had to prove both of them beyond a reasonable doubt. And the judge said no, that was a misreading of the statute. So I think the conventional wisdom is that the prosecution got more of what they wanted in this charge conference, but it's not done. I guess it continues today.
Right. And then in your closing statement, you know, I understand you, if you care about the jury, you don't want to waste their time, and you have to understand mm-hmm. they want to get back to their lives. Having said that, you want to keep it crisp and keep it direct. Excuse me for not knowing this, but who goes first, the prosecution or the defense?
The defense is going to go first in this case because the prosecution has the burden. So the prosecution gets to go last.
Okay. So if you're the defense, knowing mm-hmm. what you got or didn't get from the judge on instructions, what would you make sure is included?
I think the most important thing is Michael Cohen is really the star witness. Everybody else was window dressing in effect. So I think that you have to, because Michael Cohen is the one who is allegedly tying Trump to this scheme and also knowing about it and wanting to influence the election. So the most important thing is to hammer home how unbelievably incredible Michael Cohen is. And that's not really hard to do, because really across the political spectrum, I've been watching a lot of news coverage from other outlets too on this, just to see what everyone's saying. And no, everyone, even the ones that clearly want Trump convicted, they're like, oh, this is a really bad witness. He did not do well. He tripped up. He's not credible. I mean, you literally have your star witness going on TikTok and slamming the defendant, and in the past calling him a Cheeto-dusted demon or whatever it was. I mean, usually you have a hunch that a witness doesn't like a party, but you don't have overwhelming mounds of evidence in most cases. Mm-hmm. the way you do here. And so I don't see how the jury takes anything that he said seriously, not only based on his bias, but also based on what he admitted to on the stand about stealing from the Trump Organization. So he was a complete disaster. And I've said this before, I think if they could have brought the case without Michael Cohen, they would have, because he's a landmine. But
he provided the text messages and he provided the voicemail. So you couldn't have that without him.
Right.
And of course, they flipped him and they put the screws to him in a way that was unbelievable. They're going to put him in jail forever, basically, unless he started becoming a state's witness. And he still went to jail. But he also is not bright. I mean, he knows this profession. He knows by having a podcast and by saying his goal and wearing the shirt with Donald Trump's face on it in a prison jumpsuit. They know that by rolling out that he wants to do a TV show, he knows that by writing two books, Revenge, it shows that he's still living off Donald Trump, obsessed with Donald Trump. And now we know he's capable of doing things without Donald Trump knowing. And that's taking things from his organization. So isn't it plausible to think he also wrote this check, did this deal without the former president knowing? And what I think is understated, and you tell me why I don't hear many legal experts bringing this up. People say, well, that happened with Stormy Daniels. That happened with Karen McDougal, but it didn't happen with the doorman. All right. But they all got paid. Why? Mm-hmm. Because you need to keep negative stories down for your NDA down if you want to win elections. But if you to get it away. So I make up a story, Lexi, about me. I'm running for office. Got 2 months left. I go, yeah, let's just do an NDA with Lexi. I just don't need it. Nothing happened, but I don't need it. Oh, with those, that's a problem with my business partner. That's a problem. So I'm telling you, Judge, I already gave you an example of being essentially extorted by a doorman who said I had a love child. He didn't, but I need him to go away. How does that play into the closing arguments?
I just think that Donald Trump's intent in this is very important. And it underscores the fact that I don't think that they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that his intent was to conceal something in terms of furthering the election. He's a married man. He was a married man at the time. These are allegations that he had affairs while he was married and there were certain things going on. And obviously, if you're running for president and you are the Republican nominee, he's not just a regular celebrity anymore. He has even more of a reason to want to get NDA signed before this, because not even necessarily for the campaign. I mean, you can take out the fact that he wanted to win the campaign out of it, but just because of the increased scrutiny on him, it's going to be all over the papers. It's going to be everywhere. We saw with the Access Hollywood, that was a bombshell tape that everybody tried to exploit. So it's really no different. I mean, I can't imagine how awful and embarrassing it would be to have either true or false allegations of your personal life splashed across the front page of the news.
Absolutely. And just the whole thing is, I get more people saying, what exactly is he charged for? I mean, this sounds like if you have an election violation, you wrote out of the wrong account, it sounds like a fine. You know, let alone, you know, you already ran in 2020, and then you're running in 2024, and now they got a problem with what happened in 2015. It's on its face, it seems bizarre. I don't know who gave this case a go-ahead. But having said all that, Lexi, I don't know if you've known anyone that got a chance to look at the jury. Is there anything that you've heard that from people you respect about the body language of the jury that might be tell us anything?
Not that I've heard. I mean, I've heard at certain I've heard at certain points of testimony, you know, where they were maybe bored or maybe they were engaged. I think they were interested in the Michael Cohen testimony. And I'm no shrink, but you know, Michael Cohen has some type of serious, I don't know, personality disorder or some type of issue. And if there's anybody who would have done this behind Donald Trump's back, it would be Michael Cohen. I mean, he even recorded his own client secretly. I mean, that is like something that as a lawyer, the hair on the back of my neck stands up. Like it's not even something that I would ever even think to do, let alone do it, save it, and then turn it over to the prosecution and say, here, you can use this in the trial where I'm going to be the star witness. I mean, it's honestly, it's a very interesting turn of events. And it's also just kind of a sad, I think that was Senator Kennedy speaking in the audio beforehand. I mean, it's just sort of a sad commentary on the state of the country that this is going on. And there have been, people have made this comparison in the past, that there were other politicians that did what Trump is accused of doing and they weren't prosecuted. And Bragg has upended hundreds of years of precedence in not prosecuting former presidents. And now we have it. And I completely agree with Senator Kennedy that this might now be some, this lawfare could be weaponized by the right against the left at some point too. I mean, it's a shame. It really is.
Yeah. And you're saying that as a legal expert, this is not how the court should be used to affect elections. Lexi Rigdon, thanks so much. And by the way,
thanks,
you can follow her at Lexi the Lawyer on Twitter and all those at your handle everywhere. Thanks. We come back, one of the most impressive people you'll ever meet that I've ever met, the founder and CEO of Tunnel to Towers, Frank Siller. You listen to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's The Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. When you think of Memorial Day, you think of great groups like Tunnel to Towers. And their founder, a great friend and supporter of the show, Frank Siller, is the CEO. And you talk about a busy guy all year, but especially this year, nobody has to tell Frank to take a step back and not focus on the barbecue so much and focus on the men and women who served, lost their lives, the family left behind, as well as first responders. He does that every day. Frank Siller, welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Thank you, Brian, for having me. This important weekend here that we honor our great heroes.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're always doing special events, and now you're the Memorial Day, you're providing mortgage payoffs and mortgage-free homes for families of 36 American heroes. Recipients include 29 Gold Star families, 5 fallen first responder families, and 1 smart home for an injured first responder across 20 states. That's got to be a great feeling.
It is, look, why do we do so many on this weekend is because so many have given their lives for our country. And when people gather together, I want to make sure that we don't forget the sacrifice that's made every day from these great heroes. You know, some of these families have waited a long time for us to get to them, to pay off their mortgages so they live in a mortgage-free home with their young families. We had Army Major Thomas Kennedy, who was killed in eastern Afghanistan on August 8, 2012, along with 3 other great heroes. And he was married and had 2 small kids. And here is 2012, and I'm 12 years later, and I'm just getting to pay off their mortgage and, to relieve them of that burden. So, you know, we have a lot of work to do here at the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. There's so many of these great heroes. A lot of them that after they leave the service, Brian, they go and they become police officers or firefighters. They just continue to serve, and they're remarkable human beings, and where would our country be without them?
Absolutely. We need people to serve in the military and as law enforcement officers. Both are down, but there's some signs of coming to life. Just to give you an idea of Army Major Thomas T.K. Kennedy. Kennedy was recipient of 2 Bronze Star medals and a Purple Heart posthumously. The locker room at West Point was named in Major Kennedy's memory, and just goes to show you the need. People get the sense, Frank, well, we got everybody handled. You don't. And what kills you is the people that are out there that there's no money for yet. So if people could just sign up for the $11 a month or put a big one-time gift or recurring gift, it really helps you. It helps you budget. It helps you let people know and families know help is on the way, right?
Absolutely. Look, we're blessed. We have many people that have joined us on $11 a month, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, but I need hundreds and hundreds of thousands more. T2T.org. It's not hard to do. Most people could do $11 a month. We have 130 golf outings put on by third-party individuals this year to help us raise money. As a matter of fact, later this afternoon, I'm heading down to Farmingdale, New Jersey. There's a golf course down there, Eagle Oaks Golf Course. The owner is Dom Gatto. He was a paratrooper during the Vietnam War, Purple Heart recipient, and he's going to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for us for the Tunnel to Towers today. He has all the guys coming in from Fleet Week. You know, he feeds them. It's a remarkable day. Everybody, people with the means to do things like that should be taking the time out and saying thank you to these families and thank you to these service members that protect us. So, yes, we need the help because we do over 200 houses every single year, mortgage-free houses. We're building 60 smart homes this year alone, but I have 200 more right behind them that are waiting for me to get to them to build them these smart homes that are catastrophically injured. And, you know, so we need it. And you know what we're doing with the now I made a promise that we're going to eradicate homelessness amongst our veterans. And we're on pace this year to get another 5,000 off the street. We've done 5,000 over the last year and a half, but we're going to do another 5,000 this year. But we're not just getting them off the street. We're getting them all the comprehensive services they're going to need to assimilate back into society. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, and we need your listeners to help us. And they do. They're great people.
And you know the combination. Why is so many families affected? Why? Because you have to be in the prime of your life to serve for the most part. Usually you have young families as well. So you're serving, you're coming back. They have to sacrifice and raise their family oftentimes when you're deployed over the last 22 years. It's so often that these guys and women were deployed maybe 8, 10, 12 times. I was at Fort Liberty, and these people were telling me they were deployed. A couple of people were telling me deployed over 20 times. So you're just not home for your family. So at which time, then when they find out, oh, you don't survive because of some tragedy that happens overseas, you turn around and go, okay, I got a 2-year-old, I got a 5-year-old, I got a 7-year-old, I got a house that with the Army pay, I was barely getting by, and now I'm not going to be able to do it because my family member didn't serve the 20 years. Because without the 20, you don't get full benefits. That's when you step in. That's what's got to be driving you nuts, that you don't have enough money to handle all these cases.
Yeah, and there are just so many, you know, think of, and you're right, they're all young families because they're in the prime of their lives. You know, they're young. A lot of them are in their 20s and 30s that are serving our country. And even if they in for 20 years, what they get is nothing. You know that, Brian. It's just they're not in it to make money. They're in it to protect because they're born with a certain way about them that they make sure that they want to protect their families and to protect other families as well. So we better, as Americans, we better be there to be there for their families that are left behind when they pay the ultimate sacrifice. There's so many police officers, firefighters that give their lives in the line of duty every year. My own brother on 9/11, you know, he was married and had five young kids. And, you know, obviously I wasn't doing this stuff at that time, but imagine if there was an organization around back then.
Yep.
When all these 343 firefighters died in the line of duty.
T2T.org, Frank Siller is still working hard. Maybe we could do that too. Maybe this is the organization, the time you donate right now.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from 48th and 6th in the borough of Manhattan. We know there's going to be big news in the Bronx today at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, where it looks kind of grim. I don't know what happened. It looks like night all of a sudden, and a clap of thunder before. Hopefully it's supposed to clear up because the president's going to have an outdoor rally in the Bronx. We don't really ever hear that. I don't ever hear about a Democrat having a rally in the Bronx, let alone a Republican. I think it's fantastic. This hour, I'm going to be joined, do a simulcast with Varney and Company. We have Mark Thiessen standing by, and we're also going to go inside what is the economy. We have more and more people trying to convince the Americans that they're American people, that their economy is great and their bank account is fine, but they have a different opinion because it's theirs. And it's not the government, and it's not a number, and it's not macro. It's micro. In fact, it's mine. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The Jordanians told the MP officers that they were working for this Amazon subcontractor, but after an exhaustive search in their internal records, Amazon told us on background yesterday that all of their deliveries to that area that day were done, and they have no records or indication that these two individuals were doing any kind of work.
We're talking about the breach at Fort Detrick. Why don't you fix it? That's the message from the White House when asked about the southern border and invasion, while Homeland Security continues to evade when it comes to details on the possible military breach over in Virginia by illegal aliens, one of which came through San Diego illegally and tried to get onto our who knows.
Number two.
Is that why you used your Gmail instead of your official mail for communication with Peter?
Using my Gmail was for a different purpose. That was for avoiding more embarrassment and danger to him.
And specifically, as your emails say, avoiding FOIA.
No, well, yeah, I guess you could say that.
Yes, you could say that because that's what you were trying to do, colluding with Frank Collins, Francis Collins, as well as Anthony Fauci. Meanwhile, deceiver and liar. Fauci and friends caught hiding the facts, figures, and emails during COVID. We have the gory details, and it's only going to get worse. And an apology won't work.
Number one.
I'm confident that the people of the Bronx are not going to buy the snake oil he's selling. I mean, his presidency was a catastrophe for the Bronx. His mismanagement of COVID left a death toll of more than 7,000 in the Bronx.
You nut. That is Richie Torres, who seems to be on the right side when it comes to Israel, but not when it comes to Trump. Trump takes on the Bronx as promised. He continues to try and shine in Biden country as Joe Biden is back with a rare press conference today. Expect another gaffetastic performance, although a new Q poll gives him a little bit of hope. Let's go to Mark Thiessen right now. Mark, I got to go right to Richie Torres, the congressman from the Bronx. Does he not know who the governor and mayor were? Does he not know who got him the PPE? I was on the phone with the Suffolk County executive because they couldn't get the governor to get him masks and gloves and anything. Do they know who got him the ventilators, which, by the way, ended up killing people on their request? That was Trump, who got him the hospital ship they didn't use. He's blaming Trump for what happened to the Bronx.
So let me first speak in defense of Richie Torres. He is a absolute star when it comes to talking about Israel. He has been such a strong defender of Israel. So, you know, I give him a little bit of a pass on being a partisan Democrat when it comes to the 2024 election. But yeah, of course not. I mean, you know, the idea that Donald Trump is responsible for the death toll is absurd. And, you know, this is the guy who actually gave us, you know, Operation Warp Speed, who turned out the vaccine as quickly as possible, who got the ventilators, who did all the response. So, you know, that's ridiculous. But again, you know, look at the Bronx. I mean, I bet you anything the Bronx is going to vote for Donald Trump. Maybe Manhattan won't. Maybe there a lot of the rest of the city won't. But a lot of people in the Bronx are going to vote for Donald Trump. If you go to any apartment building in Manhattan, the people living in the high rises all hate Donald Trump. All the people working in the high rise love Donald Trump.
Right.
The doorman loved Donald Trump. The super loves Donald Trump. All the people who are, you know, because he's made the party. The Democrats have been the party of the coastal elites, and the Republican Party under Trump has become the party of the working class. And working class Americans love this president, and they want him back.
So here, Rachel Campos Duffy went into the Bronx. It's first time in her life she's been there. Grew up in Arizona, spent most of her life in Wisconsin, came to New Jersey, and made her first trip to the Bronx. And just ask people randomly, what do you think? Cut 12.
Was life in the Bronx better under Donald Trump or under Joe Biden?
It was better under Donald Trump. I can tell you that the Bronx has been through many changes. Everything was getting back on track. And then, you know, everything is like falling apart again.
Senior citizens cannot walk in the street. Yeah. Our children have been killed. Groceries, when you go to a grocery store, you can't even buy anything anymore.
Everybody needs help. People need housing. Instead of giving migrants and everybody that's coming from other countries help, we Americans, give us some help.
El dinero, mayormente a los inmigrantes.
They're giving all the money to the immigrants.
Yeah, that immigration, we got about 80,000 illegals here taking over our parks and hotels. And that is so, there's billions of dollars to giving them food that they throw out or debit cards. Who knows what they're spending it on? And then we can't kick them out of these hotels because they don't want to leave. So we can't give them jobs because it'll be more of an incentive to come here. And the working class pay the price. You think Jamie Dimon's worried about where the next meal's coming from?
So here's the thing that people don't realize is that not only is the illegal immigration issue in New York a issue of resources, right? It's also inflationary. So if you bring in 80,000 people into the city of New York and you buy food for them and the government pays for that, not only are people paying for that in terms of the government services, in terms of housing them, feeding them, and all the rest of it, there's less food, which means there's more demand and less supply. So literally the prices are going up. You know, try to get a reasonable hotel room in Manhattan today. You can't because they're all taken up by illegal migrants. So it's raised the price of hotels. All the costs of daily life in New York have risen on top of the Biden inflation because of the Biden immigration policies. So that's inflationary. So you know, yeah, if you're a New Yorker and you know you're not living in one of these high rise buildings with like Jamie Dimon and not worrying about the cost of food, if you actually have to pay, you know, your grocery, if people in the Bronx, guess what? A basket of groceries that cost $100 when Joe Biden came in office costs $125, and your income hasn't gone up by that much. So, you know, yeah, people look back and say things were better under Donald Trump.
Big news yesterday, noted on both the Democrats and Republicans. Here's Nikki Haley, cut one.
As a voter, I put my priorities on a president who's going to have the backs of our allies and hold our enemies to account, who would secure the border, no more excuses, a president who would support capitalism and freedom, a president who understands we need less debt, not more debt. Trump has not been perfect on these policies. I've made that clear many, many times. But Biden has been a catastrophe. So I will be voting for Trump.
And he went on to say, you should go out. And once again, I urge him to reach the people that keep supporting me, reach out to them. So what do you think? And where do they go from here, Trump and Nikki Haley?
Well, first of all, good for her for endorsing Donald Trump. She's right. You know, even if you are a Trump skeptical Republican or a Trump skeptical independent, you look at the Biden administration, it's an absolute disaster. You know, I mean, there's a poll out there. I think it was the New York Times poll showed that 55% of Americans consider the Trump presidency a success, which is up from 55% who thought it was a failure 3 years ago. And 61% think that the Biden presidency is a failure. And they're right. And so, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are hesitant about Donald Trump, who don't like the way he talks. They don't like the way he behaves, but they like his policies, right? Trump needs to appeal to those voters. And it's good that Nikki Haley made the first step towards him, which is what she should do. But it's his job to convince those voters to come and support him. It's not their job to come around to him. It's his job to court them, to ask them for their vote, to assuage their concerns, and to win them over. Because this election, the last election, he lost it by 42,917 votes in three states. It's going to be as impassioned as his base is. Without swing voters, he's not going to win the presidency. And it's going to be a very close election. I know Joe Biden is a disaster. Everyone thought a red wave was coming in 2022 because Joe Biden was such a disaster. And look what happened. It's going to be a close election. A lot of people are going to hold their nose and vote for Joe Biden because they don't like Trump. And a lot of people are going to hold their nose and vote for Trump because they don't like Biden. And Trump's job is to win over the nose holders.
So I watched James Carville come out, and he is sounding the alarm. And listen to The View yesterday. Charlemagne the God, big-time impactful player, and especially in the African-American community, hosts The Breakfast Club, sometimes The Daily Show. Listen to him on The View yesterday, cut 7.
I think the person who goes out there and probably energizes their base the best at this point, and, you know, when you look at somebody like President Biden, it feels like his base is pretty pissed off at him for a number of reasons.
Help him out.
Help him out by doing what?
He's like, well, what do you mean help him out? Are you crazy? It's up to a host of a morning show to go help out a president?
Well, first of all, no one can help him out except Biden. It's not – people don't dislike Biden because – he's, you know, because he's got a communications problem. They think – they dislike Biden because he's a disaster. You got to fix the policies,
right?
You know, to Charlemagne the God, even if he decided to turn his whole podcast, his whole show into an infomercial for Biden, can't fix it, can't help him out. The only person, you know, you want to help him out, get him to close down the border, get him to start deporting these people, get him to stop spending money that's increasing inflation, get him to like actually have a foreign policy where people who actually fear and respect America on the world stage again and don't start invading their neighbors and carrying out terrorist attacks. The only person who could help Joe Biden out is Joe Biden, and he doesn't seem to be either capable of understanding that or doing it.
Mark Thiessen, our guest here. Mark, we have a lot that we don't know yet, but let's just take two scenarios. Trump's acquitted. What happens to the campaign? Trump's not. He's convicted. What happens to the campaign? What changes? First off, if he's acquitted.
Well, if he's acquitted, my gosh, I mean, this is the scenario no one on the left thought of. If he's acquitted in this case, then he goes out and says, you know, he beat back the lawfare establishment to wage in war on him. It's a huge, you know, all these polls ask, how will it affect your vote if Donald Trump is convicted? No one's asking in the polls, how will it affect your vote if Donald Trump is acquitted? I mean, you know, that would be quite a development.
if he's found guilty next week, week after, well, maybe next week, if he's found guilty, I know the ads are going to roll out and say he's a convicted felon. They're going to say convicted felon and former president. You know, CNN's going to put that in every introduction, in every story. But we know about the quality of the case, and we know that this is not is anything but a layup either way, and it doesn't make sense to a lot of people. So what changes if he's convicted?
I think it's, to some extent, it's baked in to people's decision making. I don't think people have strong opinions about Donald Trump and whether he's a criminal or not, whether he's a felon or not, even before the court. It might have some small impact on those swing voters, but this is again why Trump has to focus on winning over swing voters. He's got to focus on the not the never Trump Republicans, but the not Trump again Republicans, the people who after January 6th, after everything that happened, just said, I'm done with this guy, we got to move on, and now they're being asked to support him again. He's got to convince those people to come around and make a concerted effort to win them over, and that involves, you know, focus, having a debate performance that isn't like the first debate last time. You know, focusing not talking about the 2020 election, talking about the 2024 election and the stakes in that election, talking about his record versus Biden's record, not grievances, and focusing on that. If he can do that, he can win despite a conviction.
I have a theory. I think it's brilliant. You ready for it?
I'm ready. My theory, which is mine, which is
yes, to which you'll eventually put in your column. And claim as your own. So are you ready? I believe that the gag
that's an
order.
Monty Python skit.
Right. Oh, I didn't know. I believe the gag order worked for the president, the president, because having him not talk about Michael Cohen, it doesn't elevate Michael Cohen. So now we have to just listen to his craziness. And number two is I think the debate rules on its surface, they got to work out the details of killing the mics, helps Trump. Because the more Biden talks, the more he talks in circles, and Trump will be forced to lay out, grab a pen, and just say, okay, let me take this point by point, as opposed to the instinct, quick jab, in and out, look like a bully. You might be right, but it doesn't matter. Tone matters. And I think when he goes, he'll be ready to go. I think that the pause works for him. He doesn't need it, but it works for him against Biden, because you don't want to – you get it with Biden. Let him finish. Yeah. Let him finish, and now he has to. And that's why I think it'll work. And I think the moderators are very talented. I'm not saying Jake Tapper, Dana Bash aren't talented and smart, but they just hate Trump. That's the problem. And if you need a follow-up, and it depends on the moderators, that'll work against them. But the rules on muting the mics, I think, works. Your thoughts?
I 100% agree with you. You're brilliant. And this is why I come on your show, so I can learn things. Right. The first debate last time, when he kept interrupting him, when he kept attacking him, when he did that, I think there were a lot of, if you go back to the right before the election in 2020, Gallup poll showed 56% of Americans said, I'm better off now than I was 4 years ago, which is the highest it's ever been in the history of the Gallup poll. But 56% of Americans didn't vote for Trump. There are a lot of Americans who thought they were better off under Trump, but they were just exhausted by his mouth, exhausted by his behavior, things like that. And I think he lost the election in that first debate, because a lot of people just tuned in and they said, I can't do this for another 4 years. I just can't. I'm done. And so I think you're right. If it forces him to let Biden speak. And, you know, the other thing is, Trump wins if this election is a referendum on Joe Biden. Yep. If it's a referendum on Donald Trump, he loses. And so when he's got a gag order, when he's sitting in a courtroom all day and then going off to the Bronx and having a rally, when he's in a debate scenario where Biden's got to talk, that's all good for Trump.
And it's all good for the show when you're on, Mark Thiessen. Thanks so much. Back in a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Our relationship was professional. Our relationship grew organically over time. Workplace romances are as American as apple pie, that it could happen to anyone.
Do you agree with that, Allison? Do you believe that romances are as American, office romances are like apple pie?
I feel like they tend to be much more scandalous than apple pie. I don't know.
I mean, he just says, okay, get off my back, basically. It happened, no regrets, but I ended up with a multi-million-dollar deal running a case against a former president that I've had no experience doing. I mean, this guy was doing divorce cases, and then he ends up doing his own divorce case in the middle, and then it turns out they compromised. Terrible judgment on both of them. They compromised the whole case. They said that meant so much, bringing justice to a former president trying to manipulate an election.
In a profession that is so based on ethics and your integrity.
That's all. You went to law school. You're a lawyer.
Ethics are very important.
They always go over this. So they knew about it.
Easiest way to get disbarred. Just do something unethical.
And if you're trying to play the perfect game, because you know what? We watched attorneys work cases and emerge as major TV personalities. A lot of people don't want to do this the rest of their life. So if she was running this case and put the screws to Donald Trump, she would have been in a place that almost every network would be looking for if she was impressive. I mean, take, for example, Merchant, who came out, Ashley Merchant, who came out in defense. Man, she was pretty strong. Everybody said, wow, how impressive, including former President Donald Trump. Fannie Willis, I think she's unhirable.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Leading economists aren't making much fun of Bidenomics anymore. They're thinking maybe it works to build from the middle out and the bottom up.
It is clear that President Biden's economic plan is working to grow the middle class, spur investments in manufacturing.
Turning to Bidenomics, we start from a position of strength. The U.S. economy is in solid shape.
Bidenomics, which is the word of the day, word of the week, word of the month, word of the year here at the White House. Bidenomics.
Yep, that is it. The economy's going great according to the people that gave you Bidenomics. But for the average American, they don't feel that way. The president spent at least $20 million to sell Bidenomics. It moved the needle the other way. So Neil Chatterjee joins us now, former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under President Trump, to talk about Bidenomics. So Neil, I look at these numbers. Unemployment's low. Growth is not negative. It has been strong, but the last quarter wasn't that strong. But interest rates are high and inflation's at 3.4%. The president doesn't believe that the American people are not really happy. He thinks he's got to get his message out better. What do you think?
Yeah, he's missing the boat on this. I mean, we talk so much about things like grocery prices and gas prices when we're trying to factor in the impacts of inflation. What about utility bills? You know, I'm an energy guy. I'm an electricity guy. When I served at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that was my purview. I got to tell you, what we are seeing in terms of the rise in the cost of electricity for consumers, it's truly painful. And you've got, you know, a significant number of Americans who are struggling to pay the bills that keep their lights on. And the politics and the policies of Bidenomics, quite frankly, are only going to put more pressure on those bills.
So what's amazing, Neil, is that the president of the United States said, I inherited 9% inflation, which is a flat out lie. Everybody knows it. But what he said afterwards, I want you to take on. He said everything was in place. When they tried to correct it, they go, well, everything was in place. Inflation was going to go up regardless of what he did because all of the spending in COVID. Is that true?
I mean, look, I'm not an economist, but I think as someone who just has common sense, you would think that the federal government and, quite frankly, a lot of global governments pumping that much money into the economy has contributed and exacerbated it. But I also think, again, specifically from my area of expertise when it comes to energy policy, the Biden administration has pursued policies, regulations out of EPA, putting pressure on existing sources of electricity generation like natural gas plants. All of these things also contribute to inflationary pressure and the prices going up. So, you know, he can spin it all he wants, but this is a policy-driven economic crisis.
And when you talk about energy, people think it's just about gas. What about utilities? And that really affects people. They don't understand it, and it's not predictable, right?
Utilities are under huge pressure because we've got a tremendous surge in demand for electricity coming from data centers, from AI, from crypto, from vehicle electrification, from building electrification. All of this is going to put pressure on utilities to meet that demand. At the same time, Bidenomics, Biden administration regulations, are forcing utilities to retire sources of generation prematurely that they need to meet all this demand. And the end result of this will be one of two terrible things. One, blackouts and brownouts, or two, tremendous price increases for consumers. We have had for decades now a reliable, affordable, clean, effective grid in the U.S., and Bidenomics is putting all of that at risk.
AI, as you mentioned, electric cars, as you mentioned, it's as if we're going to save the planet, but we have no idea, and we're going to make people buy electric cars, but we have no idea how they're going to gas it up, how the battery's going to act in cold and severely hot weather. But you got to deal with it, and that's just not the way it works in our country. Our economy's not going to respond to that.
It's not. Now, I've always really been impressed. You've been a big supporter of nuclear power. Why is the Biden administration not putting a greater emphasis on nuclear energy, right? It's clean. It helps the climate. It is our single greatest source of carbon-free baseload generation. Why are we not putting policies in place to better enable the build-out of nuclear in this country?
Yeah, I mean, what they do, too, they're starting to do it overseas. After the Japan tsunami and the nuclear power plant that was compromised, all of Europe started taking out their nuclear plants, as you know. And now they're bringing them back. And now New York is no longer, and California is no longer rushing to close what's left. They're rethinking it, I hope, because they become smaller and smaller. Am I right, Neil? They become more and more practical and usable.
Well, it's a little complicated. So there's a couple of pieces to this. One, the Japanese and the Europeans are realizing once you shut down a nuclear plant, it's really, really hard to open it back up. But I do agree the next generation technology is smaller. It's more efficient. It's more effective. But in the aftermath of that Fukushima disaster in Japan, you know, regulations in the U.S. significantly drove up the cost of nuclear power. And as a result, nuclear, despite its importance for reliability, for decarbonization, it's very hard for nuclear to compete against subsidized renewables and inexpensive natural gas because of all these regulations. And the Biden administration hasn't done anything to kind of remove these regulatory obstacles to nuclear to make nuclear more competitive. If they really want to do something about climate change, they should focus on nuclear power.
Yeah, where natural gas is not far behind in terms of burning clean, and the way we do it is absolutely we're better than anybody else. And we also could provide at this point all the LNG needed for Europe. And we could supplant or whatever they were getting from Russia, we could be the new ones to come in there. Also, we could do the same thing with Japan. But instead, he froze all leases on energy, on natural gas drilling. Froze them.
Yes.
And even the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania says, yeah, it's got to be for a short time and people are going to pay the price. Why he does that for ideology is insane.
So I got to tell you right now, one of the things that I'm proudest of in my career, when I was the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, we approved 12 liquefied natural gas export facilities. And right now, those approvals are saving Europe. And here's the thing. Not only do these facilities create jobs in the U.S. and stimulate economic growth, not only do they provide geopolitical value by giving our allies an alternative to Russian gas, to Qatari gas, they also displace dirtier sources of energy overseas and lower carbon emissions. So it's a win for the economy. It's a win for geopolitics. It's a win for the environment. But the Biden administration, instead of embracing this and doubling down on it, went the other way and put this pause in place that is going to have a chilling effect on investment that will have long-term ramifications because the rest of the world now thinks they can't trust the United States to be there when it comes to the delivery of this gas. And, you know, we have a huge opportunity here right now domestically, and we're blowing it.
Yeah, we are in so many ways, and we also have a chance to be a more – we have so many clients out there who want our stuff. We got to do it. Now, what do you say, Neil, to people who say, okay, Biden administration is drilling more than any other administration ever at this point. They don't want to brag about it because it angers their left. What do you say to that?
I say it is happening in spite of their efforts, not because of their efforts. Broader economic factors, as well as, quite frankly, measures that were taken during the Trump administration are now yielding dividends. And yes, oil and gas are thriving in the country today. But I want to be very clear, they are thriving in spite of Biden administration policies, not because of Biden administration.
And pipelines are the environmentally friendly way to transport oil and gas, and we're shutting them down whenever we can. And you talk to people in Alaska, like Senator Sullivan, he says, well, you would not understand how much more we could be doing, how much more we could be providing, but they're not going to capacity.
When I was at FERC, we have the primary responsibility for evaluating and approving applications for natural gas pipelines. What used to be a matter of routine became so controversial that I had to travel with a security detail. We had protesters coming to my house, harassing me at airports, coming to job sites, coming to the commission and stirring up trouble. The political left in this country has made a decision that they don't want any more natural gas pipelines. Well, the reality is there is no way that we can maintain reliability
right.
and affordability while trying to decarbonize without natural gas for the foreseeable future. There's no 2030 or 2032 or 2035. We need natural gas
gotcha.
For the remainder of our lifetimes.
Neil Chatterley, hoping you get back in charge, former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. You call it FERC, so should we. Neil, thank you.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, we have Stuart Varney. He's going to come with us shortly on over on FBN. Then we'll have a chance to simulcast and talk about something I haven't jumped into yet, but, man, it bothers me. Emails are discovered off this Dr. Morenz's email account that he deleted that had everything to do with COVID-19. Back-channeling to make sure that any FOIA request, Freedom of Information request, does not come through, therefore having them to give up emails that might show their doubt or their attacks or their research that could have played a role in COVID-19 4 years ago. So let's listen in.
Hey, Brian, I want you to take a listen to what New York Congressman Richie Torres had to say about Trump's campaign event in the Bronx today. Roll it.
So it's obvious to all of us that his priority is not the people of the Bronx. His priority is a self-pardon and self-preservation. So instead of holding a rally in Cortona Park, he should be apologizing to the people of the Bronx for the damage he's done. Look, if Donald Trump did not have a criminal trial in New York City, he would never be caught dead in the Bronx. And as far as I'm concerned, the only place in the Bronx where Donald Trump has any place being is Bronx Criminal Court.
Oh, how charming. Brian, Trump got a very nice reception from firefighters, construction workers, bodega guys. Wherever he goes in New York, he gets a great reception. Do you expect the same at today's event?
A couple of things. I just got to attack what Richie Torres said, who's been great backing up Israel. I love it. But here, he's got to be somewhat accurate. Donald Trump could be anywhere. He could be he's in New Jersey. He doesn't have to be in trial. He doesn't have to be in court. He doesn't have to be in court until next week. So he's in the Bronx because he chooses to be in the Bronx. Do you think anybody was saying, Donald Trump's so close to the Bronx, why doesn't he do an event in an open-air park? Nobody. Only one person had the guts to do it, and his name is not Joe Biden. It wasn't George Bush. It wasn't John McCain. It is Donald Trump. The same way that Joe Biden's got to go and sew up New Hampshire because he's in a dead heat, normally very, very blue, he's got to worry now because the last poll has Donald Trump 9 points from him in New York. Now, he's going into the Bronx. It could be a bit of turbulence there, but they expect 3,500 to show up. And you know what the people of the Bronx have been saying? At least he's trying. Former president and maybe future president is showing up to tell us what they would bring to the table. Would you rather ignore the Bronx like every president has done since Ronald Reagan walked through the ransacked southern Bronx? in the 1980s?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I remember that.
They're afraid that he's going to resonate. That's the problem.
Yeah, it is. Separate story. Emails show a top advisor at the National Institutes of Health deleted key records that were critical to uncovering the origins of COVID. That we had the House oversight member, Congressman Jim Jordan. We had him on the show to discuss it earlier. Here's what he said. Roll it.
Everything they told us turned out to be false. It probably shouldn't surprise us that they tried to hide the documents and the evidence that refuted and wasn't consistent with what they were telling the very people, the American people, the very people they're supposed to serve, driven by policies from individuals who never put their name on a ballot. When did Dr. Fauci ever get elected to anything? But he was running the world. He was running everything.
Yeah. What do you make of that, Brian?
Guys,
I never had a vote on Fauci.
I know a lot of people listening to us maybe on the radio right now, watching us on TV, don't know what he's referring to. They're referring to this because it's an afternoon hearing. This Dr. Morenz, Anthony Fauci, Francis Collins, all the others who made up our policies on COVID-19 and made sure everybody thought and made sure it came not from a lab, but from some type of open air market. Right. And if you said something against that, whether how qualified, unqualified, popular, unpopular on social media or on television, they're looking to destroy you. Like my next guest, Jamie Metzl, who's mentioned 6 times in these emails because they were worried about someone having a contradictory phrase or a statement against what they were saying. How about some of these emails? Listen to this. Delete. This is a quote from Dr. Morenz's Gmail account on June 28, 2021. Delete all of Peter's emails and other relating to Origin. That's Peter Danzig. We know about him. Of the before this S hits the fan. Mine was deleted long ago, and I feel pretty sure that Tony Fauci's was too. The best way to avoid a FOIA hassle is to delete all your emails. Yeah, the last thing we want to do is let the American people and the world know what we're actually doing behind the scenes. We are going to diminish you for bringing it up. We're going to ridicule you for challenging us, and we're going to ruin your lives, destroy your business, keep you out of school, and then make you alter the way you work because we know better. But we know you didn't. And that arrogance is what still destroyed our, we're still trying to dig out of today. And the educational deficit is all because of these knuckleheads who thought they were elite enough to know they'll make the decisions for us and they'll delete their fingerprints along the way. But they're being discovered now. And it's beginning to bring back all the memories of how our lives were affected by insincere people who thought they were smarter than us.
It wasn't much fun. It just was not much fun, and that's a fact. Brian, thanks for joining us. We'll see you again soon. You got it?
Absolutely.
Still ahead.
All right, so that's some of those emails that we brought out. So yesterday, some of that testimony on this came out. So these scientists are in front, front and center in front of the Oversight Committee. Here's a little of the exchanges with Dr. David Morenz, as well as Congressman Rich McCormick, Cut 13.
I think there's some misunderstanding here. The secret back channel joking terminology, to my knowledge, was never about FOIAs.
So you're going to joke about back channels to Fauci and about misspellings on queries. That's a joke. Not very funny to me.
I would have to see this communication. It's confusing to me because I had no back channel. You know, I could walk into Tony's office and talk to him anytime I wanted. There's no need to have a back channel. And I had face-to-face meetings with him all the time. So, the back channel thing.
So you deny these statements is what you're saying?
I think there's a mix-up somewhere.
So you deny it? Yes.
You idiot. You can't deny it. These are emails saying whatever you do, don't use the government accounts. Use a Gmail account. Worst comes to worst, I'll go to Tony's house. They didn't say go to his office. Go to his house. I don't have time to play another cut. In fact, I do. Let's just go more for David Morenz. Cut 14.
I've already apologized for making snarky and profane comments, but I made them thinking that they were made on my private email in a manner that was just between a small group of friends and would never end up where it's ended up. It's embarrassing to me. I shouldn't have done it, but, I accept that I did it. I don't know what to say except I'm sorry.
The only thing you're sorry about you were discovered, and it's not so much the snarky comments. You could be angry and sarcastic as you want. But you were hiding the facts from the people, making up policy just to make sure that you look good and your friends look good.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. Right now, this is the center of the world. If you look downtown, they're debating right now in Donald Trump's court case, Donald Trump versus New York. They're trying to figure out what they're going to be doing next in terms of closing arguments and getting scheduling together and find out how what the jury's going to learn about what the charges are. That would be nice, wouldn't it? Jamie Metzl at the bottom of the hour, former member of the WHO Advisory Committee and former National Security Council and official with the Clinton administration. And guess what? Jamie has mentioned six times in secret communication amongst the higher-ups with Anthony Fauci's group, the NIH, in the middle of COVID, their reveal that they were taking retribution against us and making up policies that they'd gone as they went along and were doing everything they can to avoid the Freedom of Information Act. That is you finding out what they were up to. He's going to be joining us talking about that. And Bhatia Unger Sargon is in studio. And before we get to Bhatia, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The Jordanians told the MP officers that they were working for this Amazon subcontractor. But after an exhaustive search in their internal records, Amazon told us on background yesterday that all of their deliveries to that area that day were done, and they have no records or indication that these two individuals were doing any kind of work.
Do you believe this? Why don't you fix it? That's the message from the White House when asked about the broken southern border. They don't even want to be responsible for the invasion. Well, Homeland Security Secretary says the evasion is happening. They are trying to evade arrest. I'm talking about evading Fort Detrick. It looks like two men masquerading as Amazon employees tried to breach our security. Both from Jordan. One came across our border 1 month ago in San Diego. Why don't we know more about this?
Number two.
Is that why you used your Gmail instead of your official mail for communication with Peter?
Well, using my Gmail was for a different purpose. That was for avoiding more embarrassment and danger to him.
And specifically, as your emails say, avoiding FOIA.
No, well, yeah, I guess you could say that.
Yeah, you could say that. Liar, deceiver, Fauci and friends caught hiding the facts, figures, and emails during COVID. We have the gory details and why an apology just won't do.
Number one.
I'm confident that the people of the Bronx are not going to buy the snake oil he's selling. I mean, his presidency was a catastrophe for the Bronx. His mismanagement of COVID left a death toll of more than 7,000 in the Bronx.
I think you had a Democratic governor and mayor doing their best to destroy your cities and your boroughs. But that's Richie Torres, a Democrat from New York. Trump takes on the Bronx as promised. 6 o'clock tonight, he'll continue to try to shine in Biden country as Joe Biden fires back with a press conference today of his own with the Kenyan president. Expect another gaffetastic performance, although a new Q poll gives him some hope. With me right now is Bhatia Unger Sargon, author of Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. Bhatia, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. It's great to be here
with you. What's your first impression, by the way, of Donald Trump to saying, I'll go to the Bronx, open air park tonight at 6 o'clock, come one, come all?
I think it's absolutely incredible. First of all, it's very brave. Second of all, people have been saying for ages, why are Republicans not even trying to compete in communities of color? We know that black
just
voters—
just criticizing.
Exactly. Hispanic voters are desperate for an alternative to the Democratic Party. President Trump is polling at 35% of black men. He's probably going to get much more than that. He's got, you know, over 50% of Hispanics are now polling for Donald Trump because, Brian, black voters, Hispanic voters want the same thing as everybody else. They want an economy that works. They want a border that protects them and protects their labor and their wages. They want good health care. They want access to a good education. They want choices. And they remember the economy as it was in 2019 when the bottom 25% of wage earners saw a 4.5% wage increase, historic for working class Americans. And that was under the Trump administration. People remember that.
And I think Richie Torres is the congressman from that area. And he does do strong things on Israel.
He does.
So that's great. But listen to him on Trump. He's obviously got Trump's derangement syndrome. Cut 10.
Look, obviously, we have to be careful not to treat the Latino community as a monolith, right? There are elements of the Latino community that are open to voting for Republicans. George W. Bush won 40% of the vote in 2020. Having said all that, I'm confident that the Bronx is going to overwhelmingly reject Donald Trump. Based on the polling data that I've seen among likely voters in the Bronx, Donald Trump is so unpopular as to be radioactive. You know, he's even less popular than arsenic in the Bronx. So I'm confident that the Bronx is going to overwhelmingly support Joe Biden.
Your thoughts?
I don't agree with that. I think that we're already seeing in 2020, we already saw Donald Trump moving the needle in the Bronx by about 9 points. So that's from 2020. And we know that the trends that led people to vote for him have only increased. The economy is terrible. Groceries are up 25%. Mm-hmm. People in the Bronx are feeling that very strongly, and they know whose fault it is.
And they also know the illegal immigration thing. Do you think that plays a role here?
Absolutely. It's so funny because the Democrats seem to think that what Hispanic voters want is millions and millions of illegal people coming here from the countries that they left. They do not want that. You talk to Hispanic voters on the border. You talk to Hispanic voters in New York whose limited resources are being given away to illegal immigrants. I mean, do you remember this plan from Mayor Adams to give debit cards with $10,000 on them? It's absolutely unbelievable. And if you're a working class person who can't afford groceries and you see that happening, you think that's going to make them want to vote for Joe Biden? It's not.
You know what they say? They kept throwing out the free food we were giving them. So in order to not do that, we give them credit cards so they can go out and buy their own free food from us. So you have about anywhere between 67 and 81,000 illegal aliens here. And the governor of Texas says, I'm sending them back unless you change your policies. And Mayor Abbott says, you're using people. No, he's not using people. He's saying, my problem? It should not be my problem. It should be a national problem. That's probably the smartest thing which helped Donald Trump really rage in the polls. Now, I mentioned with the Q poll, not quite as strong as the other polls for the former president. If the election was today for president, were being held right now, what candidate would you vote for? 48% say Biden, 47% say Trump. By utter definition, it's within the margin of error. If the election for president were being held today and the candidates were Joe Biden and Donald Trump and RFK running, Cornel West as well as Jill Stein, how would you vote? It would be 41-38 Biden, then 14 Kennedy, and then West with two, with Stein with two. I know they lean a little left with this, but this has got to just be a little somewhat sobering. Although Trump seems like he things are going positive, you can never be sure.
You can't be sure, but we have to stress the bravery and the courage of him going and doing this rally. He's basically saying, I am willing to put this on the line and make a showing here. I'm willing to show up for these voters. And you know what? You can't really control a space like that. We don't know what's going to happen. That kind of courage, I think, is really lacking in a lot of politicians today, where they're willing to take chances and show up in places and say, I'm going to have this conversation. I'm going to look you in the eye and make my case to you. It's really pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. One thing is pretty clear. Democrats are getting worried. James Carville weighed in on what they're seeing now, because you saw 9 mistakes from Sunday's speech. You saw a very Joe Biden speech corrected by his own staff. And then you see how I thought ineffective and poorly written with a bad message at Morehouse Communications, that Morehouse School, an all black male black school, historically black college. And he basically said you have to work 10 times as hard in order to get the same job as white people. And he indicates that cops are still shooting black people. So the message I thought was terrible. James Carville said this yesterday, cut 8.
The age issue is suffocating him. And he needs to bring up that he's only 4 years older than Trump. I mean, he's got to turn that around and need to quit fight logging and complaining about the Times covering his age and the polling is no good. That's a waste of time. Don't do that.
Your thoughts?
To ask yourself, why do the Democrats push this idea of racial division, right? We know it's not true. We know that the racism of this country is mostly in our past. We know that the real divide is not political. It's between the elites and the working class. Why do the Democrats insist on pushing this narrative that America is so racist, that America is a white supremacy? Why do they love that fantasy? And they love the fantasy because it is a way for them to avoid taking responsibility for having abandoned the working class, who used to be their base. And if they can keep pushing this narrative that we're divided along racial lines, mm-hmm. they can erase from view the radical unity of America's working class. The working class just wants a fair shot at the American dream, and the Democrats no longer give them that. And so they have to talk about racism, 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 day in and day out to hide their own failures.
And by the way, if you want to go back to racism, it's not a good Democratic story. They're the ones with segregation. They're the ones who gave us the KKK. They're the ones that pushed back on separate schools, separate water fountains, separate bathrooms. They're the ones who want separate communities. The North was much more progressive, obviously, than the South.
Absolutely. And they are now re-racializing America with the woke narrative. And there's a lesson there for Republicans as well, which is, if you want that working class voter, stop fighting wokeness and start fighting for the American dream. That's how you get these people.
Charlamagne the God, an influential African-American. He hosts the Breakfast Club. I'll be talking to him later today. You'll hear it next week. But he was on The View yesterday, and he is not endorsing Joe Biden, and it's bothering them. Cut six.
You endorsed Joe Biden back in 2020, but this time around, you say you're not going to endorse anybody. Charlamagne, now is not the time, in my opinion, to sit this one out.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't say that. I never said I was sitting it out.
What you going to do?
I'm definitely voting in November, but what I like to focus on is issues, not individuals. Like, you know, when
but
you
why not endorse?
Huh?
Why not endorse Biden?
Well, I think, well, the reality is I think both candidates are trash. So because I am going to vote in November, and I'm going to vote my best interest, and I'm going to vote who I think, you know, can preserve democracy. So if I think both candidates are trash and I don't feel like, you know, endorsing one, would you rather me endorse an individual or endorse the fact that, hey, we need to go out here and protect democracy?
So he was getting harassed in order to endorse him, and it went on a little bit further, cut seven.
I think the person who goes out there and probably energizes their base the best at this point. And, you know, when you look at somebody like President Biden, it feels like his base is pretty pissed off at him for a number of reasons.
Help him out.
Well, no, look, I actually...
Help him out by doing what?
Help him out? I mean, what are your thoughts?
First of all, The View kind of gave the game away, right? Like, they're supposed to be journalists, I guess, but, you know, they see their job as
Barbara
getting...
Barbara Walters is not the... That's not right, the image
exactly.
That she had.
They think it's their job to get Joe Biden elected. I think... I'm very excited for your conversation with Charlamagne, but I think the reason he doesn't want to endorse Biden is because he knows he will lose credibility with his black audience if he comes out there and endorses Joe Biden.
Why?
Because they know that Joe Biden has not delivered for them. I mean, what has he accomplished except for this terrible economy, millions and millions of illegal immigrants here? Those are the top two concerns for black voters, right? I mean, everything the Democrats are pushing, this whole everything, is for the elites. It so rings hollow in working class communities.
Well, I guess so. I guess we're going to find out shortly how both things are going to work. Also, let's talk about Gaza if we can. We see the ICC, pretty much most people are unanimous to indict Benjamin Netanyahu, call for a warrant for his arrest, along with Sinwar and everybody else, Hamas, put them on the same level, has gotten bipartisan condemnation. However, it looks like the prime minister is going to be invited here to speak to a joint session of Congress, and Senator Schumer is getting pressured to go ahead with his invitation from the speaker. How significant is it to have Netanyahu come over here and state the case about what things are like in Israel?
You know, I'm very happy to say that I don't buy this narrative that America is split, you know, that half the country is turning on Israel and supporting the Palestinians and Hamas. I think it's only the elites. All of the anti-Semitic activism is on university campuses. It's not the tip of the iceberg. It is the entire iceberg. This isn't Europe. This isn't Canada. We don't have millions on the streets, you know, chanting in support of Hamas. The American people will never turn on Israel, and they will never turn on their Jews.
Right.
And that is something that gives me a lot of pride.
Well, there's people like Bernie Sanders who has turned on Israel and is Jewish.
Yeah.
There's people like that. There's Chuck Schumer's been invisible criticizing the prime minister. That makes you think that it's kind of a green light to start criticizing Israel.
But I think they are losing support when they do that. It's not that they're bringing people with them. They're losing support. Look at John Fetterman, right? A Democrat. He's been out at the front of
not Jewish.
Not Jewish, defending Israel against the squad. And his popularity has only grown as a result. People want to see a backbone. They want to see a person who has values who will tell the truth.
So they're going in now. All of a sudden, it's okay to go into Rafah. They already found three or four bodies. How significant is this video that the families of these women who were taken hostages is out? The moment they were taken, it's all caught on video. Their families got it, and they said, "We have to remind the world what happened here."
It's absolutely horrific. I mean, people should watch the video if you want to see a group of heavily armed animals taking defenseless young girls as sex slaves. They literally said, these are now our sex slaves. Horrific, horrific. I think it's important to note that the video was released by the families to pressure the Israeli government. They want to see them doing more to get the hostages released. But we learned recently that it was the Egyptians who scuttled the last hostage deal.
Why? I didn't know this.
Yeah, it's recent reporting. They found when they went into Rafah, 50 tunnels, Brian, from Gaza into Egypt. There's no way that the Egyptian government did not know that those tunnels were there. And they were putting pressure on Israel, more even than the Biden administration, not to go into Rafah. And so we have to be very honest about who are our allies in this situation and who are not. And I think that, you know, Egypt and Qatar, they are on the side of Hamas. They are on the side of the Muslim Brotherhood. Right. They are not our allies. And the fact that Joe Biden, who named Qatar as a major non-NATO ally in 2021, has refused to use that leverage to get American hostages released from Gaza. This is one of the biggest political scandals in American history.
All right. Bhatia Unger Sargon, thanks so much for coming in. Truly thanks, appreciate Brian. It. Pick up her book, Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. Back in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You opened the briefing by saying it's up to Republicans to do something to solve the problem or continue to use it as a political issue. The president has the authority to do something about this unilaterally. Congress is in a divided government right now. Why isn't he doing anything?
Well, why should he have to do it unilaterally? Why should we do it in a legislative way?
Why should he do it in a legislative way? Because unilaterally, you're responsible. You didn't just get the job yesterday, KJP. The president's had it for 3.5 years. You broke the border in an unprecedented fashion. When asked, when are you going to do something? Not my problem. You fix it. Really? Is that the most irresponsible soundbite you've ever heard? I know there's a long line of ridiculous soundbites from KJP, but that has to be one of them. I mean, my goodness, why does he have to fix it? Listen to more of this. Got 20.
On the border bill, Schumer isn't even allowing amendments, and this exact text failed before. So how can this be seen as anything other than a cynical attempt to try to show Americans that Democrats care about the border?
I mean, I don't know how cynical. I don't understand how that would be cynical when it sounds like Senator Schumer is trying to do his job and move forward a piece of legislation that had bipartisan support.
It doesn't. Listen. Even Senator Langford's not voting for it because exactly what Jackie Heinrich just said. Because he said, I was there to work on a piece of legislation that was needed to be worked on. I was presenting it. And then it was used as a cudgel against him and against his party. So he says, I'm not even voting for something I came up with. So he's not doing his job. If you want something to pass, you say, okay, why did you reject it? What do you need in it? That's what Jackie was referring to. And I'm sure you all out there understand that. She goes, why he's doing his job. Do you know who they lost? They have Democrats that they lost, including Cory Booker is not voting for it. So now you're going to end up with less votes than you had before. So John Tester could tell the people of Montana, I really want to fix the border. So Sherrod Brown can tell people of Ohio, you know how great it would have been to fix the border, but the Republicans didn't want to pass their own piece of legislation. I just think voters are much more sophisticated than that. So good up. Bring it up, Senator Schumer. We also remember your comments from the 90s when you talked about the need to build a wall. And Harry Reid used to say, of course, we got to reform our immigration system and start cracking down on the border. And Bill Clinton had a State of the Union speech just focused on securing our border. We remember that. I just don't know what happened to all that. Jamie Metzl's next. We'll talk about the scandal at the NIH. Brian Kilmeade.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think there's some misunderstanding here. The secret back channel joking terminology, to my knowledge, was never about FOIAs.
So you're going to joke about back channels to Fauci and about misspellings on queries. That's a joke. Not very funny to me.
I would have to see this communication. It's confusing to me because I had no back channel. You know, I could walk into Tony's office and talk to him anytime I wanted. There's no need to have a back channel. And I had face-to-face meetings with him all the time. So, the back channel thing.
So you deny these statements is what you're saying?
I think there's a mix-up somewhere.
So you deny it? Yes.
There is no denying. It's in your email. It was found in your email box. And he went on to say, I profusely apologize, and he's embarrassed. But it's not good enough. That is an esteemed member of the NIH, and we have lost total faith in that organization, and it's bad for the country that we don't. We can't trust them when it comes to our health, when it comes to the next pandemic, when it comes to the next vaccine. And that was Dr. David Morant. He was on Capitol Hill. He's a senior scientific advisor at National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And we all wondered how these guys were making their decisions. We all wondered why people are seeing so much condemnation for those who want to speak out and say, I don't think the origins of this virus is from a open air market. I definitely don't think it's from Fort Detrick. I think it's from China, and I think it's from the Wuhan lab. And what makes you wonder, is there a chain of function research? Is there a chain of function research that resulted in this? And we were responsible. We were funding it. But if you brought that up, you were shadow banned. And we later would see the COVID files. And the COVID files would show that the government was working behind the scenes along with the FBI to make sure that a lot of these contradictory statements who ended up being right were suppressed. Jamie Metzl was mentioned 6 times in these emails by David Morantz and people communicating with David Morantz. And he joins us now. He's a former member of the WHO Advisory Committee, former national security official with Clinton years, and author of the upcoming book, Super Convergence. Jamie, what was it like to see your name mentioned as really a pain in the ass?
Yeah. You know, I've been a pain in the ass, Brian, since I was a little kid. So that part, at least, was expected. But for me, like for you, in those early days, there were just some very legitimate questions about how this terrible pandemic started. And we didn't have all the answers, but at least we needed to ask all of the questions. So, as you mentioned, I'm a Democrat. But I just was looking at the available evidence, and I said, well, maybe it comes from the wild, but I don't see any evidence of that. But there's a lot of circumstantial evidence suggesting it may well come from a research-related incident in Wuhan. And so when I started speaking up in early 2020, I was kind of persona non grata, particularly with fellow Democrats, because at that time, Tom Cotton and others had started to speak up, but I think I was the lone Democrat. But basically, this, as you and I have been talking about for many years, this is the ultimate bipartisan, nonpartisan issue. Worst pandemic in a century, 27 million excess deaths, according to the Economist figures. We need to figure out what happened. Forget the politics. Let's get to the right answer.
But what about the fact that they're behind the scenes, they were going out of their way to make sure the freedom of information requests would not yield anything that would be embarrassing to them. And then it turns out, send everything to a Gmail. If you have to see Fauci, go to his house, go to his office. And when Morantz is asked about this, he's like, out of context, we were only kidding. Cut 14.
I've already apologized for making snarky and profane comments, but I made them thinking that they were made on my private email. In a manner that was just between a small group of friends and would never end up where it's ended up. It's embarrassing to me. I shouldn't have done it, but, you know, I accept that I did. I don't know what to say except I'm sorry.
I just more am interested, what information should we all know? Why did you need to back channel with Anthony Fauci? What, was there a target list of people like you?
So I don't think, I mean, I don't know. I don't think that's the case. Certainly, it's not the right thing to do. It's a bad look. We are an open, transparent democracy, and that means that the people who are doing official business can't be hiding that business. So my best sense of it is in those early days, these guys thought that their little small group who was kind of invested in this theory of the case that it comes from nature and U.S.-China scientific collaboration is the key to the answer. They saw people like me and people like you and others as just kind of pesky people causing problems. And where they really went wrong, at least in my view, was not following the scientific method. The scientific method means you collect data with an open mind and try to see where the data leads you. And I think these guys started with the preferred hypothesis, and then that's where things really went wrong. And it started early in 2020. There was the now infamous Lancet letter calling people like me raising questions about legitimate questions about pandemic origins, conspiracy theorists, and it really went on from there. And it took a huge amount of work by a small number of us to say, hey, wait a second, this is a very legitimate question. Our safety and security depend on asking it in the most honest and thorough way possible.
Like if you called the China virus, the president, they said the president's being disrespectful. No, it came from China, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why. And don't worry about being disrespectful. Let's get to the bottom of it. And you mentioned money has a lot to do with this. Many of the emails between Marantz and Danzig, Peter Danzig, famously, privileged Echo Health with inside information about the status of its more than 4 million NIH grant projected titled Understanding the Risk of Bat Coronavirus Emergence. Obviously, if studying bat coronaviruses poisoned the world and killed millions, it's going to be tough getting that grant renewed.
Yeah, you know, I genuinely think that these guys thought, I mean, this is kind of in lots of these kinds of situations, it's not like that everybody is kind of like a cackling Cruella de Vil saying, ha, I'm doing evil. These guys thought, I believe, that they were actually doing good. But they cut corners in pursuit of what they believed. And at least in my interpretation, they were blinded by what they were trying to do. So I don't
by
think
their
they,
arrogance.
By their arrogance, by hubris. I don't think they were saying, hey, can we cause a pandemic? I genuinely think all these guys were trying to prevent pandemics. And then when COVID origins happened, and then people like me and you and others were asking these tough questions, it was very inconvenient. And again, that was the time in the Trump administration where there were a lot of people in the scientific community who had questions about Trump and about his motivations. And as I said, I'm a Democrat. I wasn't a fan of Trump, but that has nothing to do with this. This is about getting to the right answer.
Just like little things. It's not in these emails, but the 6 feet apart, as I discussed with you on TV today, you know, the 6 feet apart closed schools. It allowed teachers unions to say, I can't do a classroom without being able to get 25 kids in my classroom. So I'm going to just keep class closed. Then it turns out 6 feet apart, no one knew where it came from. Really? Anthony Fauci sat there telling us to wear two masks we know don't work. Wear them outside. Wear them during your games because it's going to be effective. While if you countered him or pointed out the hypocrisy, you were a heretic. You were being irresponsible. You need to be vilified. I know you don't care about it. It brings back bad memories. Here's more from the give and take. Let's listen. Cut 15.
Why did you choose to use personal email?
That was not government business. What happens to a private citizen in a death threat situation, in my mind, is not government business.
Well, it is government business if you are advising him, you're advocating on his behalf, you're editing things, that letters that he wanted to send to NIH. You did all that on personal email, correct?
I don't remember, but if I did, I shouldn't have done that. That's wrong.
It is wrong, and that's why we're asking the question, because you were using it for official business.
Here's more. Cut 16.
And so I got into the habit of every morning, looking at all my emails. And when I say email, I mean NIH email. Looking at my NIH emails, and some of them can be dispensed with quickly and then just deleting them. Other ones that I would need to keep or thought I might keep would be moved into a PST file so that my inbox wouldn't crash. And I must say, based on my understanding of what a federal record was, I truly don't think I have ever seen a federal record in 26 years of being at NIH. And if I'm wrong about that, I apologize because it just never dawned on me.
Yeah, so he's scrambling to unwind things that they have right in front of them.
Yeah. No, it's his testimony. I mean, in many ways, it was whatever the word, sad, hapless, even pathetic and unfortunate, because certainly we should expect better from senior government officials. And so it's certainly very unfortunate. And I think that the reason, as you said before, that it's particularly unfortunate is that our country really relies on the National Institutes of Health. Under the Trump administration, Operation Warp Speed, going from a sequenced viral genome to a fully functioning vaccine in 11 months, a very successful vaccine in relative terms, was a success of historic proportions. Our NIH has been the gold standard for National Institutes of Health the world over, but the record on COVID, not just origins, the original testing, there were a lot of things,
where shortfalls were exposed. And that's why it's so, why it's so important that we look at what went wrong and try to fix it, because there is an absolute guarantee there will be another pandemic. And if we're not as prepared as we can possibly be, shame on us.
I know, but the thing is, scientists do want to correct their behavior in the perfect world. They do want to say, I overreacted, underreacted. I do want to say, next time we got to be able to get X, Y, and Z. And we should start blaming the people that are responsible, and that's China. They should be writing huge checks. But you also write in notes to me in getting ready for this. You say it's also important. It seems strange that while we have so much from Morantz, that's the guy you're talking to, Peter Daszak, we don't have much in the way of responses or original mails from Francis Collins or Fauci or Morantz to Daszak. Were those guys that good at evidence destruction when the other guys were that bad? This is kind of a glaring hole thus far in how this is unfolding. Could we get an answer to that? Isn't Fauci due back on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, so Dr. Fauci is going to be testifying on June 3rd, and that's highly anticipated. And so certainly I'm a fan of Dr. Fauci, all in all. I'm a fan of Dr. Collins, all in all. But we have to ask just these kinds of tough questions. And I totally agree with what you just said. And you and I have talked about this for many times. The story of COVID origins is primarily a story of Chinese malfeasance. In the worst case scenario, the United States government had collaborations with the Wuhan Institute of Virology through EcoHealth Alliance. And through that, there was some funding that went from the United States government to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. By the terms of that agreement, that exact funding couldn't have supported anything that could have become the SARS-CoV-2 virus. But because there was no transparency and no accountability, and we have no clue what viruses were being held, what work was being done, or who was doing that work, basically money is fungible. And I think that's the core issue, is that when we're interacting with an authoritarian state like China, we need to have very, very high standards for scientific collaboration, and that is not what happened here.
All right, I just want to play the last big exchange. To let you know, this is David Morantz trying to talk his way out of the emails as if they're not right in front of the lawmakers. Cut 17. This is with Congressman Michael McLeod of Texas.
Do you not see that it's a conflict of interest for you to be advising someone who's working to get a federal grant on how they're communicating and approaching and even suggesting tweet revisions?
I think it would be a conflict of interest, as I understand it. Helping someone.
Is that why you used your Gmail instead of your official mail for communication with Peter?
Well, using my Gmail was for a different purpose. That was for avoiding more embarrassment and danger to him.
And specifically, as your emails say, avoiding FOIA, correct?
No. Well, yeah, I guess you could say that. Avoiding him sending something that had nothing to do with NIH business but could be FOIA'd and embarrass him.
And now it's embarrassed everybody. So this could get worse. The thing is, Jamie, in the big picture, I want answers from people. But if you just come out there and say, listen, I've been doing this for 45 years. I got to figure out where this started. I got to figure out the oranges. I don't have answers yet. These are some of the things we're looking at. And if you wear a mask, some people are telling me we should. I'm getting to the bottom of it. If you want to wear a mask, you should do it. I'm talking to schools right now about different precautions. But instead it was, we're doing this, you're doing that. If you don't do that, you're a terrible person. You don't get a vaccine. You're a lethal weapon. And you should be vilified. You stay home. You're fired. Your restaurant's closed. I'm sending inspectors in to make sure your fry cook has his mask over his nose. The way this whole was sent down from Washington, I just think is unforgivable, especially as they scramble to hide their methodology in private emails. Your final thoughts on this?
Yeah, so certainly on COVID origin, I think the right answer from the beginning is should have been, we don't know. Maybe it comes from nature or the market, and maybe it comes from a Wuhan lab, and we're going to look at everything and with an open mind. With regard to those other things, it's really difficult to be a public health official in an age of decentralized knowledge, because in the old days with polio and lots of other things, it's like there was a centralized message of what everyone should do. Maybe not everyone should wash their hands. Some people have soap allergies, but they kind of rounded out the edges. And so these guys were having to tell people what to do in a time when they didn't have all the information and nobody had. And I totally agree with what you said. They should have said, hey, here's what we know now. We don't know a lot about this virus. We don't know about how it works. Here's what we know now. These are guidelines. And maybe there are things like, based on what we know now, we think we need to do X, but we're going to be continually learning and we need everybody's help because we're doing this together.
And Jamie, the fact is, a guy with your intellect and experience, the fact that they alienated someone like you, that you had to go public with it, it shows the scope of how wrong they were, in my view. Jamie, I look forward to your book, Super Convergence. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Anytime.
You got it. Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. On The View yesterday, I found out something else we should look out for. More grievances in this world. If you're white, you're horrible. If you're a male, you're a terrible person. If you weren't born in a shack, in a basement, you have way too much privilege. Now I found out about a brand new privilege on The View. Listen to this, Caitlin Clark and Sonny Hostin.
I do think that there is a thing called pretty privilege. There is a thing called white privilege. There is a thing called tall privilege. But I do think that she is more relatable to more people because she's white, because she's attractive.
Pretty privilege? Have you even heard that in any type of conversation at your barbecues?
Well, never that phrase. I do think, yes, in some instances that might be correct if you're more attractive. However, not in this situation. I mean, she's just like the most successful female college athlete ever.
Yeah, if she was very attractive and not a good player, she'd be on the bench or not on a Division I team vying for a national title. But the numbers don't lie.
Exactly.
It just so happens she has a lot going for her, but the first and foremost is the work ethic.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.